Welcome to the Design the Future podcast, where we talk with women leading the way towards a better built world. Design the Future is hosted by me, Lindsay Baker, with Kira Gould. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Design the Future podcast. It's good to be with you. This is Lindsay.
And this is Kira.
And here we are.
Indeed. How are
you? Happy spring. Is it spring? I guess I shouldn't even say
it's
that.
It's not spring. Like,
well, it's a normal Wednesday. It is, in fact, Valentine's Day.
It is, which is very much in the winter, by the way.
Yeah. No, it's true. Although I grew up in Atlanta, and like in Atlanta, Valentine's Day was actually when we got to like debut our spring attire. Huh? So,
all right, I stand corrected.
I mean, then there's, you know, climate change. So I don't know if that's a thing even in Atlanta now, but it was. And yeah, not feeling that right now in Northern California. Nor do I even really debut spring attire like I did as a teenager.
Right. Neither do I. But it is 63 degrees in Kansas City on February 14th. So you have, there you go.
That's
pretty springy.
Anything's possible. Yeah. If you have any spring attire, you could debut it. Anyway, how are you, Kira? How are things?
They're okay. It's been a difficult week this week. As you know, we lost a community member to, she was struggling with an illness and passed away last weekend, and it's been emotional and all those things, but also, you know, at the very same time, it's such a reminder of what a loving and just beautifully networked community this is, because I've heard from so many people who Marsha mm-hmm. may have touched, and we had her on the podcast, of course, and that was an amazing moment. So I feel sad and good and emotional and all those things all at once.
it's heartbreaking, and especially sorry for you, Kara, for everything she meant to you. And just, yeah, shouting out to all of us that have been impacted by this. I want to go back and re-listen to the interview. I haven't done it yet, but I do understand it was her last public thing that she did, talking with us. And I was so touched by that she would take the time to share her work and her thoughts, and, you know, about the community and the work we've all done collectively. So if you haven't gotten a chance to listen to that episode, Marsha Matem,
she's right.
A legend.
It's a good one. It's really good. And yeah. she really was such a mentor and friend and supporter and teacher, just a wonderful person. It's a great episode, and she really I do think she wanted to do it because she felt like she had more things to share. So it's just it was wonderful. And I, you know, that's the thing. It's interesting to have the sadness woven in. I really just do feel so lucky that I got to cross paths with her and then collaborate with her. And all those things. So it's an interesting mix of things this week.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And just, you know, thinking about all these people, there are amazing people, amazing women in our community that we have lost and hadn't had a chance to interview and talk to and kind of lift up their voices. So it's a good reminder anyway, that it's always fulfilling to do this, to give
everybody some space. Well, it's so much a part of the mission, I think, of what we're trying to do, Lindsay, is just really make sure that these voices are heard and shared broadly, you know, in ways, you know, to sort of extend the teaching and direct mentoring, but also sort of indirect mentoring that all these people have in them. So I feel like it's,
Yeah, I think one of the things about it maybe that relates to that and to this sense of losing Marsha is that I like to think that these kinds of spaces can help to make our ideas live a little bit of their own life, and to have that, whether it's through just impacting other people and people being able to hear your stories or whatever. But, you know, part of what I hope we are doing here is to create the space for the things we are passionate about and the ideas that we want to put out there into the world to kind of grow exponentially on their own. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So
I think that's exactly right. I went to a lecture last night. I heard Elizabeth Colbert speak here in Kansas City. And I was thinking so much during her, I mean, she was really amazing presentation. You know, she's written these amazing books about climate change, but in a really straightforward, clear way, and not a climate emergency panicky way, just very direct. And I just was so inspired by her commitment to, you know, really looking at the facts about what's happening and like making the conversation coherent and for all of us to engage in, to understand, and to see how it connects with our lives. I mean, I feel like I just felt so many parallels to the kinds of conversations we're having here while she was talking. It was really interesting.
That is awesome. I'm jealous. I would love to see her speak. But I will say that I am particularly honored for the guest that we have today, because I know that she is also one of these incredibly incisive people who thinks about an issue that we all need to pay. Well, an issue, a realm of issues, a whole universe that we need more of our collective focus on. So we should bring her into the conversation. We are very excited today to have Lori Schumann with us. Welcome, Lori.
It's a pleasure to be here, and happy Valentine's Day to you both.
Thank you so much, Lori. We're delighted to have you. And so many of the things that you are working on are things that I think are really intriguing to so many of our listeners, and certainly to us. So I'm going to give a brief introduction, and then we'll jump right into questions. Lori has 2 decades of experience in the fields of climate resilience, adaptation, finance, and sustainability. She is the Director of Climate for Enterprise Community Investment and was a senior advisor at the Council on Environmental Quality in the Executive Office of the President, where she works on issues related to climate risk and resilience, including building codes, insurance, strategic planning, and much more. Her mission is to develop and implement innovative policies and solutions that enhance the climate adaptation and physical resilience of communities across the nation, especially those that are vulnerable and underserved. So with that, let's just jump right in. Lori, if you could tell us a little bit about how and why you got involved in climate and resilience work and community development and housing finance, what has your path been?
Thank you, Kira. That's a wonderful question. And I am really honored to be here with both of you today. I really value leaders like Marcia that were able to get some really important work done. And I think, you know, often we find ourselves engaged in work when we are making choices that, you know, sometimes they come from a very emotional place. You know, at the beginning of my career, I left my all-women school at Smith College and went right into the front lines of dealing with emergency feeding and shelter. In New York City, where I worked at the Archdiocese of New York for about 4.5 years, overseeing hundreds of affordable housing, well, actually shelters and food pantries and soup kitchens across New York City. And it was a really powerful first job because, you know, I was able to get a real intimate sight into what happens to the most vulnerable community members when they lose their home and the kind of devastation that that wrecks on a person. And I think that the moment I stepped into that space, which was incredibly, I was very fortunate to be able to do that work and honored to serve our communities, I realized what the impact of not having a house is. And so I decided to go back at some point to learn about policy solutions and systems change efforts that we can incorporate into our work so that we can try to figure out how to preserve housing and mitigate homelessness and all of what comes forward when a person is living on the street. And I saw what that does to, you know, a community. And so I went into planning school and really at that point kind of got on my path over 20 years ago to figure out what are some of the most important solutions of the day and more the most important systems change efforts to help us resolve some of the most pressing issues of the day. I started off, of course, in homelessness reduction and housing affordability, and that stayed with me throughout my life. I will say what also has given me fuel to the work I do in climate risk is my fascination with weather systems. I think in another lifetime, I would be a storm chaser trying to figure out how to track down these really powerful natural systems that occur And I've always been fascinated by weather patterns. So if you put weather patterns together with a commitment to homelessness reduction, you basically come up with what my career has been, which is a strong effort to increase affordable housing and make sure that that housing is resilient to the changing climate. I've always been involved in following projects that are very, not outlandish, but unique and complicated, never shirked away from a challenge. So I think about after planning school, I went out to California and started getting engaged with really complicated programs and projects. I got very intensely committed to environmental justice and policy work around environmental justice. One of my claim to fame in California was the development of what we call a living classroom or the eco-centered Heron's Head Park, which was an off-grid environmental education center that I had the fortune of stewarding the building of in a community, Bayview Hunters Point, which is considered a community on the front lines of climate risk, but also a community that faces incredible environmental equity issues in San Francisco. And so one of the, I think, themes of my work is I try to connect the work I'm doing to the larger systemic problems and issues that face a community. And so in Bayview, we built the living classroom because we wanted to show the world and specifically youth that there's another way to build, that there's another way to plan, that we can think out of the box and build and design our structures in a way that are regenerative and actually help to provide the community with support versus detracting from the community. And so, you know, I got really involved in building systems, and it was the first living building built in San Francisco. And then from there on, I think that started a lot of my career focus on building the solutions that we want to see. And I am very, very engaged in how do we actually build our communities and our urban systems so that they are regenerative and supportive and now adaptive to climate change. And so, you know, throughout my career, it's been really important for me to show what we mean by good policy, by good ideas, so that we can take these systems and these policies out of the textbooks and into our lives and into our homes and into our communities. And so that's a lot of what has informed my path and continues to inform my path. I love seeing things being built.
Wow. Okay. Well, first of all, Lori, I just have to say that, like, of all the people we've had on the podcast, I'm like, oh, is she hiring? Could I go work for her?
You're hired.
I love the story and the systems and policy approach, but it's also just really inspiring to hear about how you came upon this. I didn't even know your history with working on living building. Like, that's all so cool and inspiring, and a lot of threads that we get to go down today about all of this. So I'm thrilled. But before we get into some of your work a little bit more in detail, we want to ask about people who are similarly inspired to me to just come and work with you. What should people know about entering the field of climate risk reduction and finance? What are you looking for, and what should people be interested or in or good at?
That's a great question. First of all, I will say, and I'll share with everyone how I got into capital space, but I want to first say so much of the work that I'm doing now is so deeply, deeply informed by the work I've done on the ground in communities as a practitioner. So when I was working on emergency feeding and shelters, like, I was in those shelters, I was in those soup kitchens, I was working with our community members that were on the street. I was delivering food at midnight in Times Square to homeless communities. And so that kind of one-on-one work and that kind of field-based work is absolutely essential, I believe, to being a really good policymaker and a good steward of any kind of community initiative. And I pride myself on the kind of on-the-ground work I've done. I think I've spent the first 20, well, I'm not that old, but a decade and a half being on the front lines. You know, when we built a building in Hunters Point, I was on the site GCing that facility. I was articulating or administering the federal dollars we got from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. So I think that having that on the ground experience is so absolutely critical. And a lot of that work was done with community-based organizations, with nonprofits that were deeply embedded in the communities. I think after I came to Enterprise Community Partners, after Superstorm Sandy, I was brought in to oversee the recovery program that many affordable housing owners across New York City and New Jersey were going through in terms of recovering from Sandy. And I worked closely with these affordable housing owners and with policymakers and regulators, et cetera. And together we determined that we needed to build more emphasis on the needs of affordable housing with regard to climate change. I worked very closely across Enterprise with our teams. We put forward multiple books on affordable housing and climate resilience. And then at some point, we had launched a program called Keep Safe Miami, which became Keep Safe Florida, where we brought a lot of these tools to affordable housing owners across Florida and said, hey, you should think about identifying what your needs are for your building to floodproof it or to make sure it's not going to heat up. Or here's a tool. You can figure out what you need to rehab your property. And the question again and again came forward, well, how am I going to finance this? And over course of the work we were doing nationally, that question continually came up. How do we finance this work? And that's when I decided to move from the solution side of the organization to the capital side of the organization in a quest for financing that will help support housing and communities to adapt to the changing climate and changing conditions of our environment. And so I would say to folks that are interested in this work and entering it, that it's really important that you get that practitioner front-facing view so that you can understand how you can best serve your community and the kind of work that you want to do. So I'm really happy to say I came in to the financing space through the back door, meaning I came to it in quest for the goal of resolving the issues that our communities were facing. And now I feel confident that I have enough understanding of what financial supports are needed to support activating this work. And I think patience is critical. I think listening to your communities is critical. And I also think for anyone entering this field, everyone's voice counts. Never discount anyone's opinion. Everyone's voice counts. And I think that's one of the critical pieces that I've learned, because we live in a world where we're going to bound to be seeing one another in this work as we go forward. So it's really important that everyone is engaged and all voices matter.
Mm, thank you. Wow. That is inspiring. And also just, yeah, such an important context for the work. I appreciate that. Okay. We want to ask a little more specifically. You've already kind of shared a lot of things to be proud of, but can you say, at least of the work you've done so far, what stands out to you that you're most proud of accomplishing so far in your work life?
I'm lucky because I have been honored to serve multiple communities in multiple ways and given opportunities to do work that I don't think I'd ever, I just would never imagine being so lucky. So for example, when I was handed the theoretical keys to get the Eco Center built, I had no idea what it would lead me to, and that I was actually responsible for building a physical structure that had so many hearts and minds invested in. In fact, I want to share this with you, which was really amazing. So it took me 4 years to build a project that had been online for about 10 years. I came in from New York City, fresh into California, and I was given this charge to take on this community-based project. And I was living in Bayview Hunters Point at the time, so it meant a lot to me as a community member to do this work. And I was doing this for Literacy for Environmental Justice, which is a very wonderful environmental justice education organization in San Francisco. One of the powerful moments for me is we got through. So it was a building all off-grid, meaning that it treated its own wastewater on site. It generated its own electrical power and thermal heat. It caught all of its own water. We used gray water to flush the toilets, and then later Blackwater on site, native plants, every bell and whistle you could imagine we included, from the paint to the art. Everything was very intentional, working with communities, working with youth. It was built at Heron's Head Park, which is owned by the Port of San Francisco, and is this amazing wildlife refuge in the heart of San Francisco. And one of the most amazing moments was when I was given a box of, we were all done with the building, we're ready to get it opened for our big day. At the time, Mayor Newsom was with us heralding in this project, and it took us forever to get built. I won't go into this, that's a whole other video. But one of the most amazing moments was I was given a box by one of the youth that was going to learn about environmental and STEM in the building. And she handed me this box, and it was full of tiles, beautiful tiles that had been painted these gorgeous colors with different pictures that kids from around the community had painted on the tiles of various issues in the community around environmental injustice. We had tiles with the picture of a power plant with smoke coming out of it. We had a tile with pictures of, you know, birds that had been killed by some poison that the community had experienced. We had pictures of plants and all kinds of amazing pictures that youth in the community had created and put on these tiles in the hope of one day being able to use them in the center. And so these tiles were like 8 years old, 9 years old. And I asked the contractor, please take these tiles and tile the bathroom with them. And so one of the most amazing moments was to step back and see these beautiful tiles that kids from across the Bayview, mostly Black and brown, mostly low-income youth in the community, had created for the center. And that was powerful. And I think that, you know, ensuring that when you say you're going to do something, you execute is so fundamental to the work I do. Is I will not let people, I don't want to let people down. So when I say I'm going to do something, I like to execute, even if it's really hard. I think that one of the other really powerful moments for me was working with communities across Puerto Rico after Maria to put together a book on how to build back better and build back with climate adaptation in place. And it's called Keep Safe Puerto Rico. And we worked with hundreds of leaders across Puerto Rico to help articulate their dreams and vision of how buildings should be built, and specifically housing. So I'm really proud of that. And now we've got a whole suite of climate adaptation housing books that have been developed by Enterprise that I was so fortunate to have initiated. So on and on, I think that, again, when you see something that you've built and you've touched and you felt rise up in the community and be a source of support and resource for community members and to inspire change, I think there's nothing like it. It's the best feeling in the world.
Oh my gosh, yeah. This is amazing. These are wonderful things to be proud of. Well, thank you for that. And I know we are all eager for this next question, which is what are you working on now that you want listeners to know about? That sounds, I'm sure it is something really important. Tell us about it.
Well, thank you. I'm going to reflect on a project that I'm really excited about that I actually worked on when I was at CEQ, working across administration with so many brilliant colleagues to create a climate resilience framework for the nation to help us lift up the issue that we need to think about. How are we adapting our communities and our housing and our infrastructure to the changing conditions that we're facing as a result of changing sea level, increased global warming, and what are the, you know, ambitious actions that the federal government thinks should be taken to make sure that we've got climate adaptation at the forefront of our programming, policymaking, partnership building. And I'm really excited about that project. It was lifted up in September. I worked with a whole team of amazing folks across CEQ to across the whole administration to put this together, agencies. It was a whole team of folks working on this night and day. And it's really exciting because it kind of sets us up with some really deep thinking about what we can do to both set policy, create partnerships, financing mechanisms to help think about how we're adapting to the consequences of a changing climate. So you know, a lot of what we hear about in the climate change space right now is about mitigation of climate risk or mitigation of climate change from occurring. I call that the causes, right? And dealing with how we're going to reduce emissions so we reduce global warming. That is a critical piece of this. The complementary side of the coin is also, as the work happens to reduce emissions and global warming, how are we dealing with the very daily and ever-present realities that so many communities are facing across the country and the world in terms of having a storm season that seems to be getting worse, or experiencing atmospheric rivers in Los Angeles, or experiencing intense fire risk in the Northwest, or extreme heat and drought conditions in Puerto Rico, or how do we deal with a world where the winter just never seems to come in some parts of the country? And in some parts of the country, we are seeing a lot more winter. So those are very tactical and visceral and real time realities that many folks are facing. And so the question we asked ourselves during that framework development was, well, how do we make sure that we're lifting up and emphasizing the importance of thinking about how do we deal with this on a daily basis while we are reducing the world from warming? And I'm seeing a lot more of that around the country, around the world, a lot more folks invested in dealing with that day-to-day reality. So I'm excited about that. I just wanted to make sure that we talked about that. And I'm just really excited right now about thinking about how to accelerate and advance on the work that's been set forward by the administration in terms of the development of all of the great programs that are coming out of the Inflation Reduction Act or infrastructure bill, or, you know, one of many steady state programs that are now available to communities to use to improve their housing, their infrastructure. I think we have, you know, a really exciting time ahead of us, lots of opportunity to deploy this funding in a really smart and strategic way. If anyone hasn't thought about entering this field before, I would say, I think there's a lot of growth and creativity coming forward, and we will continue to, you know, build projects that, you know, are leading edge, that, you know, help set models for what a future might look like that's sustainable and resilient.
I love all of this. And I know there's like this element of it that is important to you, I know, and that just like always comes into my mind as we talk about the consequences of climate change. And it is insurance, which may sound like somehow dry, but feels like a really important driver. So I'm wondering if you can comment a little bit on like what you're seeing right now, or what we should all be thinking about, I guess, as it relates to how insurance functions in our built environment and in the face of climate change.
I'm glad you brought that question up. You know, a couple of good colleagues of mine suggest that, you know, insurance is a canary in a coal mine. I'll shout out my colleague Francis Bouchard, who's a brilliant thinker in this space, you know, signals that, you know, the insurance market is a market that's based on risk, right? Adjusting for risk. The higher risk something is, the more you pay. I mean, that's mostly with everything in life, right? If you're an investor and you're investing in a high risk project, you're going to want a higher yield. If you're taking more risk, you need more support to prepare you for that risk. Insurance is no different. The higher the risk, the more you're going to get charged. Or if the risk is this is too high, you won't be able to access insurance. And what's happening across the country is we have a lot of communities that, due to a variety of policy and historical reasons, are in high risk zones, whether they're flood zones or high WUI zones, which we call the wildland urban interface zones, high fire zones, or zones that, you know, have experienced a lot of heat due to their location. A lot of these communities are in these zones, many through no fault of their own. They're placed there. They're cheaper to build on. Zoning allows for multifamily housing in these zones. So there's a reason why these communities are at risk. And as a result of that high risk, you've got a lot of volatility in the insurance sector. We're seeing in the multifamily space that insurance premiums are creeping up to 20, 30, 40% annually because these are considered higher risk areas and higher risk deals. One of the areas of focus that I'm specifically concentrating on is how do we lower that risk? And how do we lower that risk such that we could get a little bit more stability in the insurance, specifically property and casualty insurance marketplace, such that that particular project is a little bit more actuarially rated because it's a little bit more sound, it's less risky. And so insurance carriers feel comfortable staying in that market. So I'm focused on the risk reduction. And I think that's a theme throughout my life, trying to figure out what the solutions are to reduce risk. And my proposition is the lower the risk, then we can say we may have some way to negotiate different partnerships with the insurance community. So that is not a small initiative or small effort. When we reduce risk, it means we have to build to code, modern building codes. We have to build to standards that reduce risk, whether it's flooding or fire. We have to figure out how to finance that risk reduction. We have to think about our community-wide risk. Is there a better way to reduce risk than just building by building? Perhaps we're looking at the community scale. You know, think about flood walls, think about perimeter support. And so reducing risk is a whole slate of actions that and strategies and policies and mechanisms that have to be put into place. Many parts of the country are thinking about this right now because, you know, we are moving into an era that, you know, insurance should not be our first line of defense. And I think often it has been seen as the first line of defense in many cases. It should be a complement to a property or a facility or an infrastructure project that is has risk reduction baked in. And so, you know, again, insurance is a critical player and a critical partner. The carriers, the reinsurers in our climate adaptation advance. And I'm really excited to just see how the conversations are unfolding. It's a really exciting time for the insurance industry right now.
That is such an interesting positive spin on a topic that I just find endlessly fascinating. I'm so delighted to hear you talk about this. And in such an intriguing way, I love this notion of building in risk reduction into the project in a more sort of holistic way, rather than just leaning on insurance in that way that you described. And this is a little bit related. I would love to talk a little bit about communication about these topics. Obviously, that's what it's my area, what I do. And so I'm very interested about how you think about and engage with various stakeholders about these concepts with clarity and purpose. I mean, it is complicated. And as you were just describing, it's a sort of unfurling ecosystem of connected things. So it's difficult to communicate in really brief terms. So I'm just curious if you could share a little bit about that angle.
You know, it's communications is so critical for this work, and yet we're still lagging. And I think in part because, you know, often these conversations become really academic, really quickly, really theoretical. And, you know, these are conversations that we need to break them down. We need to talk about, you know, how do we communicate in a way that everyone can understand? And I mean, for me, I've been working in the space of building to educate for so long, whether it's building the eco center, whether it's like one of my first jobs in graduate school was working with the Friends of the High Line as their first contractor or employee, I guess you would say, helping them to basically make the case that if we remodel or rehab the High Line in New York City, it will be a great educational tool for the schools. And I remember going around Chelsea with the founder of the High Line, Joshua, and we would talk to principals of local public schools and say, you know, we really hope you support the High Line because it'll be a great curriculum builder for your kids. And sometimes the principals would be like, yeah, but what does that look like? What do you mean? And then it got built, and look at what the role of the High Line is, or whether it's being involved in helping to steward the construction of the Bronx River Arts Center, a environmental education center in the Bronx, which we basically embedded all these cool systems in, solar panels, you know, heat pumps, to show the kids what we mean. So I'm a big fan of building to educate, and that we should approach every conversation as if we're educating folks, and that we're educating folks that may not know what we're talking about. Most of the time when you build, and I, you could probably correct me on this, but most of the time when I've gone into building books or other, you know, communication tools, we think about the fact that we may be talking to someone in a ninth grade level. Okay. So then how do you make sure that you're not being over technical, that you're speaking in as plain speak as possible, not because people don't know what you're talking about, but because it helps to build the case. And so I think I envision a world where when we talk about climate adaptation, people can then point to built systems all over the country, whether it's dune restoration projects that highlight nature-based solutions, whether it's putting, you know, vegetated roofs on buildings to demonstrate stormwater recapture or heat island mitigation. I think it's time we move out of the textbooks and into our streets and communities and build these systems. And I'm really happy to see so much amazing support that, you know, the administration has put forward to make this possible, to build the solar panels, to install the heat pumps, to create the stormwater systems that we can then use to educate our peers. And then I do believe that that has an effect of going viral.
Yep.
I hope.
Yep. Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. I saw Elizabeth Colbert speak last night, and she was talking about the social contagion, right? Of when people model little behaviors or build something a certain way, one thing isn't going to make the difference, but there's a social contagion piece there. So
absolutely. And we've seen it with the stormwater management systems. You know, all across the nation now, we have green infrastructure in communities that are recapturing stormwater.
Right.
And it's no longer a unique thing. It's kind of like how you do business.
Yep, absolutely. Well, that's so great. And I'm sure that resonates with Lindsay too, because so much of what ILFI is doing is trying to really show, you know, what's possible and then let that catch on. Because once people see the potential there, and stormwater is such a good example too, because it's integrated into parks in so many beautiful ways that, anyway, sorry, tangenting here wildly.
I love stormwater. That's my peril.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do want to ask another question. It's a little bit about how we're thinking. You know, many people in the built environment community tend to think about resilience at the building level. And you just referenced this a minute ago about the importance of thinking about resilience at the community scale. And I wondered if you could talk just a little bit more about that.
Sure. You know, if you look at how communities have adapted to climate change or natural hazards around the world, we find that there's often an integration between the building-based site and the larger scale community space, landscape, what have you. I think, you know, when we talk about how we adapt, it's very complicated to focus on individual sites and get the kind of scale that we are going to need to be able to truly adapt to the changing conditions in our environment. A lot of the risks that we're facing, such as wildfire risk, by its essence, has to be adapted to or mitigated at the community scale, because by the time it gets to the building block and lot, it's too late. So there are risks and perils. Flooding, for example, also, the best investment is often trying to ensure that you've insulated the buildings from this risk, because by the time that risk gets to the building, it's too late. And so with limited investment dollars, the question many of us are asking, like limited investment dollars and limited capacity and limited capability to actually administer the dollars, especially if they're public, many of us are asking, maybe you get more bang for your buck if you look at a community scale approach. And there are initiatives and programs that are available to support community level approaches, such as the FEMA Community Rating System, which is a great program. If you essentially treat your community scale and bring the community up to a state of resiliency, you actually get a return discount on your flood insurance. And so that's a great return on investment. I've worked deeply with individual buildings for a long time, and I've often wondered if we could take the same time that we're spending on those buildings and put them on to working at a scale much larger than that building and working in partnership with the cities, municipalities, and state authorities that will be able to get more return out of our investment of time and money. I think that I see a lot of opportunity in the urban space. We don't always have the good fortune of having the ability to have a community level approach. However, we're seeing more and more in New York, where New York leadership did form a community level approach and came forward with some really great designs and projects that are now bearing fruit. But we don't have a lot of space. We don't have a lot of green space in a city like New York or places like Chicago or Atlanta. So you have to then think about what are some innovative solutions to dealing with the community level approach. Community level approaches, of course, then call for community level partnerships and partnerships with your local jurisdiction. And I think I see a lot of opportunity as more jurisdictions develop resiliency plans, as more jurisdictions understand the risks that confront communities, impact tax base, impact revenue, and it's important to address those at a community level. So I think that, in short, I see a lot of opportunity. I see emerging examples. And I think that the other point I would like to make is that there's a lot of opportunity when working at the community level to think about community financing to help make those projects come to life. So only a community can issue a bond, right? A jurisdiction can issue a bond. And I think that's a critical tool for financing some of this work. So it's an exciting area that I'm exploring.
I really appreciate that frame. It's something I feel like I have to work on myself a lot, but it's we're trying to spend more time thinking about what works at the community scale, because that's where this real solutions come from. So thank you for that. We have two last questions for you, and one of them is so big, but we're just all learning so much, so please brain dump what you can. What do you think of as the major progress areas these days in the world of climate risk and reduction, and where do you feel like there hasn't been enough progress, if you just had to kind of say high level?
I think that where we need more support is first on the financing of this work and understanding what do we mean by adaptation scope? What's the return on investment for an investor? What are some structures that might work for different communities in terms of bringing private sector dollars to these projects? I'm excited to see that that's emerging, but I think there's a lot of work to do to really define this. I also think there's a lot of work that we need to do in terms of how do we coordinate among different entities to make these projects come to life. And so I think there's a strong coordination role that often goes untapped or unnoticed in a lot of these larger deals. But I think that between the two of those, I think that that's where I'm seeing some gaps.
All right. Well, I'm sure the work is cut out, but we're excited to see where this goes. And thank you. Before we wrap up, we have one last question for you, Lori, which is about who inspires you. And this can be anybody that you've come across or people that you keep tabs on out there in the world. But yeah, really curious to know who you look to for inspiration.
Two people. One is my mother, of course, because she was the hardest working person I've ever met in my life. And, you know, this is about hard work. It's about persistence. It's about endurance. It's about hard work. It's about sacrifice. And, you know, anyone who embodies those qualities is an inspiration to me. And I think, you know, I think our president is a real inspiration to me because he's 81 years old and he's devoted his life to this work. And he is dedicated, and he's got endurance and persistence and love for the country. And I think that to me is a model. I think I'm more inspired by those personal attributes, right, than necessarily how smart you are in this space. I'm inspired by people that are willing to do the hard work. If they don't know the answer, they go find it. People that are kind to one another, people that are able to be patient. Those are the kind of folks that inspire me. I couldn't say there's one name because there's so many folks I think about when I think of this. But I would say for me, inspiration is informed by those attributes and that kind of persistence and that kind of, you know, hard scrap kind of mode of being. And that may apply to everyone, people in your life as well. But I would say if you want to follow someone who's doing great work, I love the work that Catherine Aya, who's doing at communications, she's out there, she's making things happen, she's communicating, and she cares and loves this work.
Yeah, I love that. Yes, thank you for that and for the frame. I appreciate just getting the work done.
Yeah,
it's that's I agree. Well, okay, with that, we are out of time, and it's just been a complete pleasure and inspiration, Lori, to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
You've made my Valentine's Day. Thank you both.
Thank you so much, Lori.
And thanks, everybody. That is it for us this week on the Design the Future podcast. Thanks again for listening. Please leave us a review on Apple. Keep them coming in. It really matters. It helps people find us. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.